And we are in verse 18. And we've seen last night that we're beginning to investigate the resources at our disposal so that we don't have to be constantly crippled by a daydreaming fantasy life or dirty mindedness that tempts us back into living the old lifestyle. And we saw there in verse 18, of his own will begat he us with the word of truth. Now notice that he begat us. In other words, he knew what we were like before he took us. He didn't have to have us. He has chosen us in Christ. And that is the difference, because it means that we need to get ourselves out of that syndrome of thinking that if God ever knew what I'm really like inside and what I think, he'd throw me away. That is not true. He will never throw you away, slap your face, or walk out on you. There's the story of the two little girls in the playground, and one of them had a skip rope, jump rope, and the other didn't. And the one without the jump rope came up and said, "I want your skip rope." The other one says, "You can't have it. I'm using it." And she says, "But I want it." And she says, "You're not getting it." And the sister says, "Well, keep your jump rope. But I know something about you you don't know." She says, "No, you don't. Yes, I do. No, you don't. Yes, I do." She says, "Oh, what do you know about me? I don't know." She says, "I heard my mother and father talking about you in the kitchen last night when I was supposed to be asleep. And I heard them saying that your mother and father aren't really your mother and father. You're adopted." And the wee girl with the jump rope just about burst into tears. And then all of a sudden a big grin crossed from ear to ear. So the other one says, "What are you grinning at?" She says, "Isn't that marvellous? Your mother and father had to have you, but I was picked." And that's true. You can pick if you're being a foster parent or adopted. My wife and I are foster parents for the Lancashire County Council. And I remember going to the children's home one night. And I said to Grace, "Now you just, we're playing around with them. You pick out who you think you would like, and I'll pick out who I think I would like. And we'll see if we can concur. And we'll ask the Lord to guide us." And these kids are wise. They know that somebody's up for grabs to become a parent, you know, get parents. So they're all putting on their best airs. And so when we're finished, we went into an ante room. And I said to the my wife, "Who have you picked?" And I wrote a name on a piece of paper and hid it. And she says, "David." And I took my hand off and it was David. Now David was, his mother committed suicide in front of him when he was 3. And his father ran away and left him locked in a room in the slums. And went to sea as a sailor. And the welfare discovered him suffering from malnutrition and polio. And he had a caliper on one leg to stop him overusing it. And so we chose him. And on the way home, he cried. And I said, "What are you crying for? Do you want to come with us?" And he said, "Sure." "So why are you crying?" He says, "Because the other kids in the home said I didn't have a chance. That people don't go around picking cripples." And there's an awful lot of truth in that, in that we think we should never be chosen if we're crippled. If there's any fault in us, we shouldn't be chosen for service. We shouldn't be chosen by God to be his children. We should be sent away to iron out the defects, then come back. And that's not true. He has, of his own will, begotten us to turn us into being a kind of display of his creatures. But that takes a process of time, changing us, adjusting us. And it's vitally important to give God that chance. But it's a good help in the face of your old life and your memory to understand that relationship can never be broken. Even if you live like a pig. And there are Christians who possess God that live like pigs. But God knows that. And you don't have to fall foul of thinking, "Well, how can I tell him? How can I break the news to him? If he finds out, he'll throw me away." No, that's not true. He knows that. And some Christians do live awful lives, but God is still working on them. He's still going to change them. And he chose, knowing that, and that he's going to adopt them, give them instantaneous sonship. And once you have a relationship to Christ, you can't break it even if you live like a pig. Only the Christians will not give you mercy. But God always does. Always. He will give mercy. You see, I have three kids. If one of my girls runs away and ends up being a prostitute, stealing, lying around with any old man, and ends up being knocked down by a bus and being taken to hospital, the first thing the nurse is going to say is, we need some details. Who's your father? Well, if she looks up at the nurse and says, I don't have one, because I haven't lived at home for 20 years, they'll say, dear, we're not interested in how long you've been on your own. We want to know who your father is. Yes, but I'm a thief. Thanks for information about your extracurricular activities. We'll not lock the safe tonight. But who's your father? But I'm a prostitute. That is a wonderful hobby if you like it, you know. But who's your father? And whether she likes it or whether she doesn't, in the long run, she's going to have to turn around and say, Billy Strachan begot me. I am the result of an egg in the mother and a sperm from him. He is my father. That's the relationship I have with him. And once there's a relationship to God through Christ, and the germ of eternal life is within you, it doesn't matter what kind of a behaviorism you have after that as you grow up to mature. It doesn't alter the relationship. You can relax knowing God is my father. I might be a pig, but he's my father, and he's going to work on me and change me. And if you grab that, then you won't fall foul of, well, with a mind like this, I might as well quit because God wouldn't love me. He will never stop loving you. Never. Some more advice. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, you are beloved, you see. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Three things to do in a practical level in the face of dirty-mindedness and the temptations of the mind. And that is, number one, be a quick listener to God's word. What it's telling you on how to overcome this. Number two, slow to speak. Learn to keep your mouth shut. Because what happens if you get frame A up, that now I'm a Christian, you will give me a perfectly pure mind, and you wake up to discover it's cluttered up with the junk and the dirt of the last 20 years you built into it, and God doesn't answer your prayer by cleaning your mind out. The minute you fall foul of temptation through the dirtiness of the mind and its seductive memory playing back and you go and do it again, your first reaction is to open up your mouth and blame somebody. And very often you blame God. Where were you? Why weren't you there to protect me, to save me? Do you know what? I actually had a student on one occasion that came to see me. And he says, I'm giving up my faith. I'm quitting the faith. And I said, why? He says, God let me down. Oh, tell me about this. Well, I have a girlfriend, and went home with her one night, and at the door she said, are you coming in? And I said, are your parents in? And she said, no, they're away for a week. But why not come in and have a cup of coffee before you go on a chat? And so I went in and we sat and we chatted. And we get just so busy chewing the fat and eating the chocolates and drinking the tea and watching the telly that before I knew it, I'd missed the last bus home. And she said, well, don't worry, you might as well stay the night. After all, we know that we're very deeply in love with one another and heading towards marriage. And so he says, so, we went upstairs and went to bed. And now she's pregnant. And God let me down. I said, what do you mean God let you down? Well, we prayed. As we got into bed, we prayed and said, lead us not into temptation. I said, son, God never let you down. He did. He never answered our prayer. I said, he didn't need to answer your prayer.
Why, was it wrong to pray? No, it was where you prayed was wrong. You should have prayed at the front door when she says, Mummy and Daddy's away for a week, are you coming in? You should have prayed for the guts to run like mad for the bus. At that moment. And didn't you know that the natural processes of being a normal human being is such that no man or woman can climb into a bed with each other and pray, dear God, reverse the whole processes of natural manhood and womanhood for the evening. God will never answer that prayer. Because he may want you to get married. And what use are you going to be if you suddenly discover God answered your prayer and you're both incapable of having sex with each other? A load of rubbish. And people are so quick to immediately come out the minute they fall foul of the internal temptations of their mind and sin to say, God let me down. It's God's fault. Either that or it's the pastor or some deacon or parental mismanagement. And everybody wants to pass the buck. Nobody wants to look in the mirror and say it's me. And it's as old as Adam and Eve. God came to the man and said, what have you done? He said, don't look at me. It's the woman that you happened to give me. Did I ask you for her? Whose idea was it to produce her anyway and bring her here? So ultimately, God, the blame's yours. And God turned to the woman and said, what have you done? She said, it was the snake. Don't get at me. What's the idea of picking on me? Have you any suggestions as to who made the serpent? And ultimately, everybody blames God. It's interesting, you've read the whole book of Job. The mess that that man went through, and from chapter 1 to the end of Job, not once did he ever suspect it was Satan. All the way through, he blamed God. They all thought it was God. And that's why it says here, listen, if you want relief to your own mental anguish, point one, remember you're chosen. God's not going to change his mind about the relationship you have. Point two, be quick to hear God's word on this issue. Point three, shut up. Stop jumping so quick to conclusions that it's everybody else's fault but your own mind. And three, here in this verse, which is the fourth thing, is be slow to wrath. Stop getting frustrated and losing your temper about it. Because when you get frustrated and lose your temper at having failed again, you'll try to do something about it. Instead of realizing you can't. It's going to take the miracle of handing your life over to Christ to let anything be good come out of it. Wherefore, remember this, the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God. To get frustrated, lose your temper in the face of temptations and kick and scream and have a tantrum to try and convince God that you're really concerned about it. It's just of the devil that. It's of the earth. It's sensual, it's devilish, it's rubbish. Wherefore, lay apart all filthiness. This is something you're asked to do. Lay apart all filthiness and superfluity and naughtiness, and receive with meekness the engrafted word that's able to save your mind, will, and emotions. You see, one of the first parts is acknowledging that you are what you are from birth, sinful. Even though you're now a Christian, you're a sinful Christian. And no good people get to heaven, only converted sinners. And you have to keep reminding yourself you're still a sinner, though converted. And keep that in your mind. Then, for relief of what your mind would tempt you to do, lay apart all filthiness, superfluity of naughtiness. In other words, start a new behavioral change through the power of Christ, not to go into the den of lions and expect God to keep the mouth shut. Learn to stay away from the area where you're guaranteed to be tempted. You see, although it says in Ephesians, put on the whole armour of God, you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Paul also gave advice to Timothy, and that was from some of the lusts, run like mad. So there are some things where you logically keep it alive. Keep it alive and alert and conscious at the front of your consciousness. Here is a situation I'm going to visit. If I get myself into that situation, am I likely to give in to the weakness of my temptations of mind and do it again? And your answer will be honest. And you'll be able to say to yourself, yes, I will. Given half the chance, conditions right, I'll go and blow it again. Then if you know that in advance, by not suppressing it and pretending that's not there, if you keep the thought very much alive and face it, you then can do something about the circumstances not to go there. But if there's some place they want to take you, you logically say to yourself, now, if I was in that situation as a Christian, would I succumb or wouldn't I? And if you honestly believe, hey, it's just no sweat to me anymore, it just wouldn't bother me, then you still go there. You see, you have a chance to change your circumstances if you will keep the thought of the mind alive instead of pretending it isn't there. Because repressed stuff never evaporates or disappears. It actually grows bigger until it kicks the cupboard door open and wrecks everybody. You have a duty to practically occupy yourself in laying aside, occupying yourself in taking action that would prevent sin. You know, I had some pastors at a seminar that said to me, Brother Strachan, we've observed that you tend to say in your testimony that you have come from a very rotten background prior to conversion. Life that was morally, mentally and physically wrecked. Yes, I said, that's perfectly correct. It's interesting to note that in your diary all down the years, you keep going to places like Copenhagen, sin capital of the world, Toronto with its Yonge Street, Vancouver with its Stanley Park. I noticed he knew the places too. And he would mention, you know, Greenwich Village and Berkeley and Hamburg with its Raper Band and Vienna with its Lisbethstrasse, you know, and seemed to know all the areas. He says, tell me, when you go to these places these days, are you ever tempted? And I said, oh yes, all the time. In fact, there isn't a hotel in the world where I don't walk in and as I'm signing the register, there can be immoral people all around the mezzanine hallway. And they can be giving me all the signals that their bodies are available while I'm in that hotel. They seem to have a sixth sense and know I came from that pigsty. He says, well, what do you do? I said, I go down my corridor to my room, lock my door, throw the key over my shoulder, and cry myself to sleep. He said, come, come, surely you don't go to sleep at 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening. I said, no, I seldom sleep until midnight when I travel. He says, so what do you do with the empty hours? Oh, I said, I crochet. And they roared and laughed. One was even visiting the house and saw a tablecloth and said to my wife, testing it, nice tablecloth. Suppose you made that. And Grace says, oh, good grief, no, I haven't got time for that. I've got too much to do. My husband does that while he travels. He says, you mean he really does? Yes, I do. I constantly make wedding gifts that occupies hours. But do you know something? When you get a letter from a pastor saying, Brother Billy, I was at that seminar and I somehow or other feel I can talk to you and you might be able to help me because I just don't know what to do. Because you see, I've just messed up my ministry. Lost my family. Because I committed adultery. Well, of course, my immediate reaction is to suggest he goes and buys a crochet hook instead of laughing at me. Maybe if he'd done it, he would have still been in the ministry. You see, we have to be streets ahead of the enemy. Lay aside things. And do what you can do practically to alleviate your own suffering. You see, I cannot land in America, have 3 empty days and find myself ending up in a motel, committing sin and saying to the Father, well, I couldn't help it. It was just 3 empty days. You see, because my diary is 4 years ahead of myself. And so in other words, I know 4 years ahead that I'm going to have 3 empty days. So I do have a 4-year opportunity not to just wait till then and pray, deliver me from evil, but to get my typewriter out and type to some of my Christian friends in that community to
to give me a place to stay with them while I'm there on the empty days. And it's amazing the number of times when over here I have to arrange maybe a fishing trip, mountain climbing, canoeing with some past students and friends, because I'd rather do that than spend empty days in one of those dens of iniquity, impersonal places where it would be so easy to sin. And then another great relief is receiving the engrafted word that's able to save your soul. You see, you cannot read this book and stay the same. And if your mind is annoying, you open the book and start reading.
But I don't get much out of it.
Nobody's asking you to get anything from it. We're just asking you to read it. Nowhere in as a Christian have you been ever asked to go into the book and get anything from it anyway. Christ said the Spirit will teach you. He didn't say how much, when, and that it would be instantaneous illumination. And I've been reading this book back and forward for 30 years now, and I'll tell you this, you can't read this book and stay the same. It's a word that ends up becoming a part of you. And that engrafted word is able to keep your mind, will, and emotions. It becomes strength. It becomes what you need in the face of temptation. The trouble is, many people give it a read, two or three verses, saw nothing, shut it and say, God's just not speaking to me. Why should I bother? Well, all I know is I've read it and read it and read it. People even ask me today, when do you prepare and how do you prepare? Well, today I get very little time in my Bible school to read, because people are always knocking the door asking for help. But in the early days of my Christianity, there were great periods of time when I was overseas, in Denmark in particular, where I had meetings scattered through 5 or 6 weeks. Just a few of them. You could have done them all in 1 week, but for some unknown reason they were spread throughout, and I didn't know the language at that time. And so in the years when I didn't know the language, what was I going to do all day? Well, I did one of the craziest things imaginable. I just sat and read the Bible from lid to lid. Every year I went over for weeks, I just read the Bible, read the Bible, read the Bible. Never saw anything in particular. The amazing thing is that today I look back knowing that the foundation for all of that I've ever learnt was gained at that time when I read it and thought I got nothing. Because when I started to preach, stuff came back. I couldn't even remember reading it. But God gave it. And it stayed with it because he builds it in line upon line, here a little, there a little. And I've always found that if your mind's wandering, open the book, read some of it, and you find that it helps. But, verse 22, be practical, be ye doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving your own self. For if any be a hearer of the word, not a doer, he's like a man looking at his face in a glass. For he looks and sees what he looks like, goes his way, and immediately forgets what kind of person he was. So is everyone that looks into the Bible and forgets to go and do it. You see, lots of people know the truth. The only thing is, they never get around to doing the thing. To do it. There's one guy we had at Cape Mary on the temporary staff. This guy had leadership potential coming out of his ears. And it was so evident, he could just snap his fingers and the whole staff lined up and said, Yavo. You know, they were ready for anything. But the thing is, he was misusing all of that to lead them astray. And his biggest problem was he was a downright lazy bum. And he asked me once to baptize him. And I remember taking him into the water. He was massive size. I said, come in deeper. I need you in deeper water. So walk further into the pool where I would have less trouble dipping him. And he suddenly said to me in front of all the people watching, have you got a text for me? And I said, yeah. From John 2. Whatever he says to you, do it. And I dunked him. Held him down a bit and then let him back up. I said, but the only text you could give that guy, whatever he says to you, do it. Because it's amazing the people that can get a degree in theology, but they've never learnt the art of actually taking the stuff and going out and doing it. But whoso, verse 25, looks into this perfect law of liberty. Yes, it's a law. But the amazing thing is, if you do it, you get free. It's a law of liberty and continues therein, makes it a process of obedience.
He being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man should be blessed in his deed. You don't get blessed thinking about going to do it. You get blessed actually doing it. That makes the difference. Now, another way of helping your dirty-mindedness and the problems of your mental anguish inside is to go out and practice true religion. And from verse 26 through verse 13 of chapter 2, it is talking to us about the practice of true religion. If any man among you seem to be religious, seems to be, and outwardly it looks like a good churchgoer doing everything right according to the book, but he's incapable of controlling his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is empty. In other words, the guy that can't even say, look, what I'm saying isn't what I'm doing, I better keep my mouth shut until I get the two balanced. He's deceiving himself because on the basis of saying the right churchy things, he thinks he's spiritual. And that's not true. But pure religion, here is the religion that helps with our mental problems. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. You don't have to guess. Occupy yourself by visiting the fatherless and widows in their affliction and keep yourself unspotted from the world. Bored, are you? Fed up with hours with nothing to do? One of the best cures is introduce a new word to your vocabulary, and it's called others. Helping others. And he's picked out the two groups that are absolutely in need of somebody. Fatherless and widows. Now remember, fatherless doesn't simply mean the kid's daddy's dead. It could be a kid from a home where the father's as good as dead, but is still physically alive. He's behind his paper, he's working out his computer, he's doing his big business, he's making his millions, phones at his side, and he hasn't noticed that he sired a son or a daughter yet. And they're crying out for attention. I took 6 students with me this winter to a public school in Oxfordshire in England, where there were about 400 lads. Most of them, their parents are military or in the diplomatic service, ambassadorial service, different parts of the world, and they're stuck in there for school, and in the summer they go over to some big embassy somewhere in the world or diplomatic compound just to play for a few weeks till they get back to school, but they seldom see their parents. And I took 6 hulking male students with me down there, and we put one in each house where these lads stayed, and they just stuck to those guys like daddies. They were father figures. We led half the school to Christ that week. And we went back the weekend before school finished, and I came over here just for a surprise visit to see them all again. People hungry for a daddy, hungry for a mother, hungry for somebody. You see, instead of sitting wanting attention and demanding attention, the best thing to do to relieve your own personal mind and temperament and moods is go find somebody you can give yourself to and help them, help others, others, others. I was at one church and they were talking about, you know, problems with some people. There was one woman that wanted to join the church, and they took a church meeting, and the deacon got up and said, there's no pastor. And they said, then I was this visiting speaker, Mrs. So-and-so in the village has asked if she could be admitted to membership. She has come to Christ through listening to Billy Graham's program, Our Decision. Oh, they went to town on her. Her? Over my dead body, says one woman. She's not coming into this sanctuary until we see a change of life in her. She can't even put the 2 curtains in the window the same color. Have you seen her house? Filthy. The kids are absolutely filthy and messy, and the smell would knock you down as you pass them in the street. And another one says, yes, when they come into the shop, it takes you all your time to serve them. And boy, they were going on at great guns about the poor woman and her family. And when they finished taking her to strips off her, the deacon turned and said, any comment, Brother Strachan? Imagine inviting me for a comment. Dear. I got up. I said, one question. Nobody's mentioned the woman's husband. Any idea about him? Oh, he's an alcoholic. Oh, so he probably drinks all the wage. Yes, that may account for their poverty. I suppose so. And how does she survive? Oh, well, she's out working all day. Oh, so the poor woman survives by working all day to come home and climb into bed with an alcoholic and is so probably worn out she hasn't time to clean the kids, the house, or anything up and just makes do with what she's got. I was at a young people's prayer meeting in this church last night, and if I remember your prayer request, looking at the president of the youth group, it was, Dear Lord, thank you for blessing our money this year. Help us to guide us in what we should buy, a new pool table, a new table tennis bats and table tennis table for our club room. You ever thought of forgetting the games and spending some of that money and go down and buy the woman two pair of curtains that look the same, cleaner floor, wallpaper and decorate the lounge? Some of you girls ever thought of sitting down, you know, knitting sweaters, socks, things for their kids? And how about some of you ladies, instead of sitting here for your weekly knitting bee, which is your gossip machine to find out who's pregnant this week and who's getting married and who isn't, you ever thought of just scrapping your midweek little meeting and going out of the church and going down there and helping her to dye curtains, showing her how to cook, how to clean up a house, how to cope? Needless to say, I've never been invited back to that church. Yes, bunch of hypocrites. Others, even the night my wife and I married, we noticed a man that didn't come. His wife was there. So on the way down through the country to where we were going to honeymoon, we diverted our plans to call in, and we're glad we did, because he went to be with the Lord 3 days later. I never went back to that church for 10 years. And when I was on the platform 10 years later, sitting on a Sunday night waiting for the service to begin, I saw her open the door and come in. I immediately left my seat in the platform and went up the aisle and gave her a hug and a kiss. Everybody was sort of looking to see what I was doing leaving the platform. And I gave her a hug and a kiss, and she burst into tears. And I said, "What's the matter?" She says, "That's the first hug and kiss and touch of a human being I've had since George died 10 years ago." But she's got to be in that seat if she's evangelical on a Sunday. After all, what would dear George think, looking over the battlements of heaven, if he didn't see you being faithful in your place on Sunday, where he would want you to be? So be there every Sunday. Nobody ever says to her after the service, "Would you like to come home for lunch? Would you like to come on vacation with us?" And personally speaking, there would be less trouble amongst young people on the sex game and pregnancy if even some of the older ones, instead of telling you nothing before you're married, if they'd open their house and let you come in and spend an evening with them. There is no ministry to singles, because they may have to switch Dallas off and talk to you. And then they wonder why their own lives are not blessed. "But God, we're down there every Sunday at 11. I don't care tuppence whether you're there on Sunday at 11. If the rest of the week you're not out relieving your own mental anguish and torments and filth of your mind by being helpful to others, what a waste of time. People are longing for somebody to care. Go care. And you'll find that you're so busy you haven't time to sin. My brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect to persons." And incidentally, just before you jump to a conclusion, "Oh well, I'll start being a good boy and a good girl now, and I'll go back to my church and find people to help," would you please note that true religion works without respect to persons? Stop going and picking the ones you want. Try picking the ones you don't like. Dig that for a start and a challenge. I had a student that walked in to me 2 years ago and said, "Billy, I need a challenge in this school. What would challenge me and deepen my faith?" And I said, "Do you know so-and-so in this school?" And he said, "Oh, him? Everybody knows him." I said, "Go be his friend. And if that doesn't break your heart this winter and challenge you, nothing else will." And you know, he rose to it, and he went to be a friend to the one person that everybody was leaving as though they were leper. And the criticism we went through, people were saying, "What are you wasting your time with him for?" And he did. Actually, it's the time you waste for your friends it becomes valuable. Really valuable. You have to do it without respect of persons. I once had a coffee bar in England, and there was three hippies came to Christ on the Wednesday. They came every night, we got them deepened, we got them introduced to somebody, we'd take them to a home Bible study. And they said to me on Saturday night, "Hey, Strachan, we're coming to church tomorrow." I said, "Don't." I said, "Why not?" I said, "They're not ready for you yet." "But we're Christians." Hallelujah. It's great to know you've got the confidence, you've now received Christ, you're now a brother and sister in the Lord. But the church isn't ready for you yet. "We're coming." I said, "All right, but don't say I didn't warn you." And they came to the service, marched in all their mess to the front row, eager faces. Front row, in a meeting. While all the stalwarts of the faith were up under the balcony with their big hats and peppermint. At the end of the service, I went to the door with the pastor. And the first man out was a well-dressed gentleman with a Homburg hat, rose in his lapel. Immaculate pinstripe suit, and he came up with his little walking cane. And he said, "Did you see what we had in our sanctuary this morning? In the holy place of God? Trash. And if you're going to start letting trash like that come into our Sunday morning services, Pastor, and ruin our sanctity and our holiness, I for one am not coming back. That's all I'm saying this morning to you. Good morning." And off he went. And the pastor looked at me and said, "What do you do?" I said, "Take him up on his offer. Go home and write him a letter and say, don't come back, you're a hypocrite. The church is a place for rotten people. And if you're here tonight and you're not rotten, you better get out because you're in bad company, because I am. And there is no need for a respect of persons. If there comes to your synagogue a man in nice gold rings and good clothing, and there comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you have respect to him that wears the bright, clean clothing, and you say to him, 'Oh, sit thou here in a good place,' and you say to the poor man, 'Stand thou there or sit under my footstool,' are you not then partial in yourselves and become judges of evil thoughts, beginning to evaluate the heart of a person on the basis of how they look? The tragedy in the church is you can have somebody leading an organization in the most expensive, up-to-date clothing, their knuckles covered in gold rings and carbuncles of diamonds, pearls around their necks. And then the whole mess collapses. But we thought on the basis of what they looked and how they performed, they were godly people." You'd never think of going and sitting down beside somebody dirty and making them your friend. "Listen, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith, and heirs of the kingdom that is promised to them that love him?" You know, I'd love to take every one of my students annually in an airship straight into the Brazilian jungle. Do you know that I had more love and care from native people living 2,000 years behind us in cultural development than I've ever had from a church? A man hugging me and thanking God he'd been allowed to live long enough to meet his white brother in Christ beyond the big waters, beyond the jungle that his tribe only discovered existed for the first time in history 10 or 15 years ago. That meant something to me, especially since all he was wearing was three bird feathers in his nose. We wouldn't let him in our church. He couldn't be born again. What a rubbish. Rich in faith, but poverty stricken. "But you have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you?" You people in James's day that he's talking to, he says, you know what it's like to be conquered by the Romans. Isn't it true that these rich Romans oppress you? They can stop you in the street. You're on your way to see your mother-in-law or your children. And they can stop you and force you to pick up their belongings and carry them 2 or 3 miles. And you can't say no. They could put you to death. You're under Roman law. Don't they oppress you? and draw you before the judgment seats, drum up a case against you to get you flung out of your house so that they can claim your home. That was a well-known tactic. Do they not blaspheme the worthy name by which you are called? Don't they criticize you for being Christians? Do you like it? Well, no. Well, what do you think about other people? If you fulfill the royal law, according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. The one part of being a Christian is you have within you the Christ who's able to keep the law for you. You don't keep it. He keeps it for you. But the law that gives you a sense of majesty and dignity, like putting a crown on your head in any community, is when you learn to love your neighbor as yourself. But of course, here's the crux. Half of the Christians don't love themselves. Or they wouldn't be such big phony liars that they are. They wouldn't put up a performance. But people love their performance. They don't love themselves. If they really loved themselves, they wouldn't be that phony. No wonder Paul says, I want you to be sincere Christians. Now the word sincere is two Latin words, sin without and seres wax. Paul knew what he meant when he said, be without wax. In those days, the best thing you could buy for your house was a Greek statue. Some great towering hulk of a male, nude, in the corner. You know, physique, something like mine, Clint Eastwood, you know. But the thing is, those statues were expensive. So what happened? There was the bucket shop brigade round the corner, the Woolworths boys, the 5 and 10 cent store characters. They took a piece of marble, cheap stuff. They chipped it away until they had this big Adonis-type statue there. And they got it as polished up, and it looked tremendous. The only thing was the tip of the nose was gone, an earlobe missing, cracks down the thigh, and a heel knot there so that it rocked a bit. But that didn't worry those guys. They took candle wax, and they moulded an ear tip, moulded an earlobe, filled in the cracks with wax, stuck on a wax heel, and sold it for a fortune. You took it home, you thought you'd get the real marble thing, and everybody that came to your house said, oh my, isn't that wonderful that you've got one of those? Greek, is it? Yes, just because it's so reasonable to. And everything went well till you turned the heat on. And one day as you passed the statue, you thought, it needs its nose wiped. Then you realized it wasn't a dripping nose, it was the wax. And you noticed every time you passed it now, it rocked a bit. And then you looked at wax trickling down the legs. And suddenly you realized the thing was full of cracks. And you were conned. Do you know something? Paul says, Christians, you ought to be Christians without wax. Oh, but Brother Billy, if I was without wax at my church next Sunday, they'd all see the cracks there. But for once, they'd know who they were dealing with. They'd know what they got. They wouldn't be getting a phony anymore. But we so love our phoniness and refuse to accept ourselves with our weaknesses that, do you know something? We go out into the community and we hate anybody that shows their cracks, anybody that shows their flaws and their weaknesses. And what are we doing? We're busy forcing them to be as phony as we are. We refuse to love ourselves. We refuse to love them as themselves. It's time to be real. Time to be a real person. For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he's guilty of all. For he that said, don't commit adultery, and said also, don't kill. Now, if you commit no adultery, yet you kill, you'll become a transgressor of the law. So speak ye and so do as they that shall be judged by the law of liberty. What's this business of classifying sin? Putting it into its depths. In the Bible, God puts gluttony and homosexuality and adultery and murder all in the same verse. And I'll tell you something in my observations of Christians in this world. There are more Christians in this side of the Atlantic going to die of overeating than homosexuality or adultery. And yet now in the church, we're classifying what's bad, what's worse, what's not so bad, what's a smidgen of sin in it. And the way I see people sitting down hogging themselves until they're dying of cholesterol, and they no longer recognize it as a sin, but God did in the Bible. He called it gluttony. And if you've never committed adultery and never done this and never done that, but you're eating like a pig, you're as bad as the rest. And it's just sheer phoniness to start classifying people bad, worst, very bad, and judging them, who you want around, who you don't want around, the church has something very severe to answer for. In its attitude, in its judgmentalism, in its demand that everybody perform and play the game, which has nothing to do with what Christ came in to do. He came in to fulfill the royal law in you and through you by living his life in you and through you. And when he does, he accepts everybody without question and begins to work for change in their heart. Haven't you read it in the book? Sitting at a well with a prostitute and led her to life. They brought a woman into his presence and they said, "We caught her in the very act," which means they lifted her off the bed, and typical, they let the man go. But they brought the woman through her in front of him and said, "Now, what says the law?" And all Christ did was bend down and write in the sand. We're not told what he wrote. But there came a moment when he looked up and there was nobody there except him and the woman. I wonder if he just looked around the crowd at the people saying, "What says the law?" and looked at a rabbi and just wrote in the sand, "I know a rabbi that had sex behind the temple last night with a young girl that came to say prayers," and then just wiped it out. "I know a person that last night eat like a pig, went and regurgitated and went back for more. Just wiped it out. I know a thief who's been taking money out of the temple for years, rubbed it out." We don't know what he said. There's one thing certain, by the time he finished, they'd all gone, and he turned to the woman and said, "Where are your accusers?" She says, "No man has condemned me." He says, "Neither do I, but go and sin no more." He didn't say she didn't sin. He says, "I'm merciful."